So I was having dinner with some people last night. It was actually some work colleagues because I'm on half term at the moment. And they said, what are you doing this half term? And I said, well, tomorrow I'm recording a podcast about tweeding James Bond with the granddaughter of someone who acted in James Bond films. And they all stared at me as if to go, is that like the most niche thing ever? And I was like, yeah. And yeah, so that's why we're here today, isn't it? Talking about
Amazing.
tweed.
To talk about Tweed and
No, I'm so glad you're here, Rosie, because I know next to nothing about fashion. Obviously you've got a special familial connection to
yeah.
James Bond. Do you
More
want to
than
more than one.
one.
So do you want to kind of introduce what we're going to be talking about today and why we're
Yeah,
discussing it?
sure. I'm going to begin in with a couple of disclaimers that might mean people stop listening or might mean that people forgive us later. The first one being that I'm not technically a James Bond fan.
Get that out there now.
Just gonna put that out there. I've watched
Yeah.
very
We're
few of the
trying to
movies.
convert you.
I've
We're
been being
trying to convert.
slowly converted for a large portion of my life by somebody you all know very well, Kim Sherwood. So I have read her books multiple times, and texted her once we decided to do this, and said, "I think I might now need to read a Fleming Bond if I'm going to be on a podcast about it." So that's disclaimer number one. Disclaimer number two is that I am not a fashion historian or a textile historian in any way at all. I am an artist and have begun recently in my art working with natural fibers, and sort of the very beginnings of what I think is going to end up being fabric art. And I've been knitting for a decade as a hobby for, the joy of it. So that's the sort of angle I'm coming at from for sort of talking about tweed. So there will be, I am sure, fashion historians and textile historians in the Bond community who probably know a lot more than I do, for which I apologize. And I hope you'll forgive us if we get anything wrong or if we miss something interesting.
Well, you certainly know a lot about it compared with me. It's been a steep learning curve for me, to be perfectly honest, for this. And we'll get to that in a second. I'm just going to back up for a second and explain how we ended up here. So, sometime early in January of this year, someone I posted actually, someone had posted online a heraldic map of Europe. Bear with us here, folks. This is. And it's only going to get more obscure as we go. So a heraldic
That's what
map of
that's
Europe, and
today's mission. How niche can we get?
how niche? Yeah, that's it. So I posted a photo of Sir Hilary Bray from Honor Majesty's Secret Service, as played by your grandfather George Baker, and we'll talk about him in some detail in just a moment. And I said Hilary Bray would have loved this. And I am fascinated, as long-time Licensed Queer listeners and viewers will know, and I've written articles about him as well. I'm quite fascinated by that character in Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and we'll talk about all that in a minute. But then someone who follows Licensed Queer on Twitter, the account Fan of Fleming Bond, big supporter, posted off the back of my post saying, I know we have Jim Fanning Friday, thanks to Licensed Queer, but when is Sir Hilary Bray Day? I wonder what it would involve. Brass rubbing, wearing tweed, and never being one to let a good idea go to waste. I
Or back
thought,
down to
when is
the
Sir Hilary? Yeah, because
challenge.
there aren't actually that many dates in the James Bond fan calendar. We have James Bond Day, which is the date that Dr. No was released originally, October the 5th.
Yep.
And then we
Day
have,
after Jim's birthday.
obviously, Jim Fanning Friday. Which Jim
Yep.
Fanning Friday is a bit like Easter. It moves around a bit
It
from year to year, but
James,
it's always
the
in the
doctor
latter
would
half
never be
of
able to
February.
find it.
No, exactly. And then I thought, right, we have to choose a day for Sir Hilary Bray Day. I thought it has to have some significance. So I actually looked up George Baker's entry on Wikipedia and some other sites. and tried to find significant dates, and I actually ended up with the 1st of April. So perhaps you want to say why is 1st of April the date we're going for, for Sir Hilary Bray Day evermore?
So the 1st of April, as well as being April Fool's Day, is my granddad's birthday. We as a family thought that he would get a really big kick out of celebrating Sir Hilary Bray Day on his birthday. He would think it was absolutely marvellous. So it's going to be really, really joyful having that fall on his birthday. I think he'd think the entire thing was really funny.
I did think, it being April Fool's Day, is this a good idea or not? But it was when I ran it past you and your mom, I was like, and you were on board, I was like, okay, we're good to go now. Yeah. Let's go for it. So 1st of April this year, 2024, he would have loved it, would he?
Yeah, he really would have done. I think he'd have found the entire Bond, sort of the contemporary Bond fan community, just to be such a joy. Having the recognition for, you know, what wasn't a particularly huge character in terms of like the length of, you know, he played Wexford for a very, very long time. But I think he'd like, you know, his contribution to the canon being recognised in such an amusing fashion.
Actually, he has, say it wasn't a majorly significant character, but of course he actually revoiced James Bond for about a third of the film.
He did.
So he overdubs George Lazenby, although his screen time, his actual physical self, is not on screen for more than a couple of scenes.
You hear his voice.
He actually does have a significant role. Yeah. And of course he's in The Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah.
As Captain Benson. In the Admiralty, and I've yet to actually find this, so I need to watch really carefully when I go back through it. He's apparently in You Only Live Twice as well.
Really?
Yes, he's a NASA technician. Live Twice.
The way history tells it, he was Fleming's choice for Bond. He saw him at a restaurant or a private club or something somewhere and said, "That's my Bond." But he was in film contracts that he couldn't get out of, so he didn't get to play him. That wasn't something I remember Kim finding that out in a History of Bond book and just being like so annoyed that he'd never told her, because she was already a huge fan by that point. But I think he was, you know, I'm sure there was some regret that he didn't get to play one of the most important characters in British culture, but I also, you know, I think he was really proud of the parts that he did play within it. So yeah.
And he did actually appear in a film opposite Sean Connery, didn't he, in 1960? Yeah. I've yet to actually watch that as well, but there are some. I've seen some production photos.
Yeah, I can't watch my granddad.
No.
As a child, I watched him in Little Lord Fauntleroy, and in Johnny and the Dead, which were the two sort of things he made. I think really for his grandchildren, so he was making things we could watch. But growing up, I wish I had now that I'd watched them growing up. But I found it a bit sort of, I don't know, embarrassing, awkward. I don't know what it was. And now it's just too sad, which is why I wish I'd done it when he was around. But yeah, so I know my cousins watch him and get a lot of joy out of it, but I can't.
No, I understand that. I did actually message. Yeah, no, I messaged you early this morning saying I'm actually watching your granddad in an episode of Up Pompeii as well, which I'd never actually watched before. Yeah. I didn't expect you to watch it as well. But he did actually get to play James Bondus. So those who don't know Up Pompeii was a kind of very bawdy innuendo. The whole thing is just innuendo. All the humour is based on innuendo. So there's all these sorts of slightly saucy. It's like if you're a British person, you know what I meant by a saucy kind of beachside postcard. It's that sort of bawdy humour, very, very silly. Everything's a sexual metaphor. But he was actually in an episode of that in 1970, so only the year after On Her Majesty's Secret Service, playing James Bonder. So it's really interesting for about 10 years of his career, then a little bit into the late 70s with Spoiler Love Me, he had all these James Bond associations. And also something I didn't realise before researching for this podcast was that he was actually a neighbour of Peter Hunt, who was a director, the director of Honour, Majesty's Secret Service and the editor of the first five Bond films. So that's how he ended up essentially being kind of cast in Honour, Majesty's, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. He was good at that onerous term networking. he was a member of, you know, a number of those private clubs in London, which sort of politically were not something he would have agreed with at all because he was a proper socialist, but were necessary for, you know, going and being seen and talking to the right people and reminding people of his, you know, stature, literally and metaphorically. Yeah. He was a tall man, my granddad.
And he was also, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, I'm aware this might come across as a bit awkward, but he was also a very attractive man.
He was a very attractive man.
Very, very attractive. So if you've only ever seen him in kind of the latter stage of his career when he was playing, I'm going to use the word fusty a bit, quite a bit today, because we're talking about tweed, and that's the number one word that tends to come up when you come across Twitter. But he did play some roles later in his career.
Yeah.
Which weren't necessarily kind of, dare I even say, sex symbol roles later on. However, but earlier in his career, he did,
Well, that, you know, I think if you see early photos of him, if you see photos of him from his sort of late teens when he met my grandmother onwards, you know, you can see why Fleming looked at him and said, oh, that's my James Bond. Like, he looks like Fleming's description of Bond, and he's suave and gorgeous. So, you know.
And you've brought up your grandmother as well. So we need to bring her into this as well, because, well, you tell us all about your grandmother.
Yeah, so my grandmother, Julia Squire, was the daughter of Jack Squire, who was a poet, Sir Jack Squire, I should say, you know, to give him his full title. He was knighted for his contributions to literature and architecture because he saved, I can't remember how many, but he saved a number of Wren churches and other significant pieces of British architecture from being pulled down, and stopped the farmer who owned the field that Stonehenge was in from pulling Stonehenge down. Yeah, he was an important guy. So she was his daughter, and she was a costume designer for stage and screen, set and costume designer. She was, I think, she was one of the first, if not the first, woman to do the fashion and costume design course at Central St. Martin's. And by the age of 24, when she and George met, she was already a successful enough costume designer that there was a newspaper announcement about their engagement that said costume designer Julia Squire engaged poet George Baker, because he wasn't even he wasn't anyone yet. He was still, you know, poet, penniless poet. So yeah, she was a pretty big deal. She worked on a number of huge movies, including the original Moulin Rouge, for which she was the costume designer, and then her name was taken off. Was taken off it when the costume design got an Oscar nomination, and a guy that had not been the costume designer had his name put on it. And she did Port Africa and Under Capricorn and The Magic Box when it was being done for the was the British film contribution to the World Fair. I can't quite remember, but yeah, she was a very big deal. And she's
she must have worked John Huston, Alfred Hitchcock did in the Capricorn,
so both so she and then George's third wife Louis, who was the grandmother I knew. Julia died when I was very young. Louis worked with Hitchcock as well. She was it was Mrs. Wexford in the in the Wexford TV show.
Yeah, of course.
Long prior to that, she'd been an actress, a very successful one, and she'd worked with Hitchcock, who wanted to adopt her.
Oh, wow.
So, multiple family connections to Alfred Hitchcock. She used to lunch just tell stories about Hitch, and it took until I was in my teens before I went, hang on, back up, do you mean Hitchcock? Now tell all these stories again. Sadly, I never got to hear Julia's stories in person because she died in 89 when Kim was born. So I was only three. So yeah, when they got married, it was announced in the papers as costume designer Julia Squire marries poet George Baker. And for those that might be watching this recording, that's them getting married. You can see how young he was. And there's a really lovely little sort of story of their wedding day in George's book, The Way to Wexford, which I've never actually read. So this is the first time I've read this story, and it's really sweet. It says, my mother was thrilled with the news that I was going to get married. I suppose she felt... Really, Jem? Sorry, interruption from the dog. My mother was thrilled with the news that I was going to get married. I suppose she felt she could now fully shed any responsibility for me. Julia's mother, on the other hand, suggested that her daughter take me to Paris and get him out of your system. Julia was deeply shocked. Julia was working on The Magic Box, the film industry's contribution to the Festival of Britain, which starred Robert Donat and every star in the firmament playing a cameo role. It was an exceptional opportunity for a 24-year-old designer, and Julia was working very hard. On the day of our wedding, 22nd of December 1950, she attended a full day's fitting with Robert Donat. He was difficult to fit because when he had an attack of asthma, his neck would enlarge and go from size 15 to 18, so he had to have three sizes of collar. His asthma didn't diminish his sense of fun. He knew that Julia was on tenterhooks to be gone and teasingly delayed her. We were supposed to be married at St. Barnabas Church in Pimlico at 6 o'clock, but, owing to Robert Donat's sense of fun, we were not married until 7 o'clock. The congregation consisted of Julia's mother and brother, Rag, my mother, and Mr. Wade from Roehampton. Peter Meyer was my best man, and there was one or two other friends on either side. Pat, Terry and Evie were not there. Those are George's brothers and sister. I could only think they were still at school. After the service, Rag gave us a reception at his home in Chester Row. Julia and I then went to dine at the Society, Helen Cordat's nightclub in Jerram Street. I had taken a one-bedroom apartment in Chesham Place where we spent our wedding night. The day after the wedding, there was no lingering in bed. Julia had to be up early to go to the studios. However, Ronnie Neame, the producer of The Magic Box, gave her 4 days off over Christmas, and we borrowed a cottage in the Cotswolds from one of Julia's friends, and this was our honeymoon. Very sweet.
Wow. That is really sweet. And as you were reading, there were so many names, like anyone who knows anything about the British film industry, like Ronald Neame and all those names. I was just thinking, oh my gosh, you know, the circles that they were moving in.
So we have this amazing box in our house. That's been one of my favourite things since I was a kid. It's an old Kodak photographic paper box, and it's completely filled with photos from Julia's designs and from the film sets. So I dug out one from The Magic Box, which is what she was filming, doing the costumes for the day they got married.
Oh God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And we've also got like photos of her designs for Under Capricorn. So that's her dressing in Good Burgwin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, it's pretty cool. She was a incredibly talented woman.
But as you pointed out, probably, you know, her praises could have been sung even more, and that's a horrible trend in film history, that women's they've been sidelined quite a bit.
Too easy for the women that were actually responsible for the extraordinary pieces of cinema to be, and a story that's very familiar to the Bond community.
Yes, it happens.
Joanna Harwood was forgotten for a long time for her contributions to the movies.
And I remain convinced that Joanna Harwood, without her, we wouldn't actually still have Bond today, because the version that would have gone onto the screen would be too kind of overly masculinized in that sense, like an American hard-boiled kind of Marlowe type sort of character instead. I
wouldn't
don't
have
think the character
survived.
would have had that longevity.
Wouldn't have survived because it wouldn't have tapped into the, you know, British cultural subconscious, you know, collective desires, because it wouldn't have been British.
So I know you say you're not an expert on fashion, and I know these things aren't passed on genetically. However, I still think you're the perfect person to take us through tweed in the context of Sir Hilary Brayday, because obviously because of all those connections. And obviously because you've committed yourself to learning so much more about this. And you're actually, you're starting to kind of sew yourself, is that right?
I'm starting to sew myself. So I had an operation at the end of last year. And to continue our theme of things being really, really niche, I spent my recovery watching a fashion historian on YouTube named Bernadette Banner doing historically accurate reproductions of Edwardian and Victorian clothing, which she sews completely like with the techniques they would have used at the time. So she like has a hand cranked Singer sewing machine from the era, and like hand stitches things, which is extraordinary. And I kind of adore her. It's also like really hypnotic and very, very relaxing. She's a good video artist as well as a fashion historian, costume historian. And I came out the other side of it thinking, okay, you know, I've learnt to knit quite well, made this jumper, you know, got quite good at it after a decade. it might be time to learn to sew things other than knit, you know, learn to make clothing other than knitwear. So I bought a sewing machine in the sales. A friend of mine who is a fashion historian and does make her own clothes took me to a beautiful fabric shop in London, and we bought some patterns and some fabric. And I immediately gravitated to the wool and the tweed because it's so pretty.
That's the thing, isn't it? So much tweed is so pretty, but it has all these connotations with people of it being quite old-fashioned in some ways. But actually, there's such a range of tweed. Like,
It's got this reputation, I think, of being, as you said, sort of fusty and old-fashioned and belonging to a particular sort of particular groups of people throughout history, particular classes, particular backgrounds, particular interests. You know, sort of connotations of aristocracy in England and Scotland, and connotations of sort of, you know, Ivy League universities and Oxbridge and, you know, things of that sort. But I think, you know, if you were to walk through any major city and like spot who's wearing tweed, I think that would quickly be revealed as being a lie. I think there's probably more tweed amongst the hipsters in East London than there is, you know, collectively anywhere else in the country. For good reason. It's a gorgeous fabric.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. You sent me an article which I found really revelatory, which was quite, I think it was from the Gentleman's Gazette.
Yeah.
And I read the whole thing, and essentially that rural association goes back to tweed, a bit like denim being quite a tough working material. Yeah. In the mid-19th century, it was popularised amongst gentlemen, and then Prince Albert, as in the husband of Queen Victoria, made it fashionable. So is that am I in the right lines with the sort of history of tweed there?
Yeah, so I think the drawing a comparison to denim is quite a good one, because it started very much as a like working fabric. Like it was a working man's fabric. Like wool is a high performance fiber. Like it's durable and it's like naturally quite waterproof and it insulates. And if you're raising sheep, it's affordable. You can work it yourself. You can make it yourself. So it was, you know, traditionally being woven for like workers' clothing. Like it was, you know, it was cheap and affordable. Prince Albert gets a lot of credit for being the person that kind of made it fashionable with the aristocracy, which once again sidelines a woman in history. So there was a woman in 1846, there was a woman named Lady Dunmore, who was a widow, and she had her clan tartan woven as tweed by the Harris weavers in the Hebrides. And they did it so beautifully and so successfully that she then started getting them to weave tartans and tweeds for like all of her friends in the aristocracy and like sent them around the country and around the world. And that's actually how we made it like into tailors' shops in London and like onto Savile Row and into the sort of high end of aristocracy, and is where Albert then like found it and popularized it even more, obviously, because he was a prince and married to a queen. But yeah, people sort of go, yes, and then Prince Albert's like, actually, once again, there was a woman involved. which
seems quite Scottish origins as well, doesn't it? In fact, because I know far more about linguistics than I do about fashion. But all of the origins of the word for tweed are kind of tied with Scottish things, and it's possibly tied to a river tweed in Scotland. Is again, am I sort of on the right lines there?
Yeah, as far as I could find out, there's sort of like no one specific moment where the word tweed appeared. There were mills weaving tweed near the River Tweed on the Scottish-English border. Right. I don't think they were necessarily the first people to be weaving it. The legend goes that a sort of bolt of tweed came down to a tailor's in London, and it was labelled tweel, which is the Scots for twill, which is a kind of weave for fabric, where the sort of lines in the fabric go in diagonals. And not knowing what tweel was, because the, you know, people in the shop in London didn't speak Scots, they thought it was tweed for the river. So they labelled it tweed, and it kind of just like became a hit and went from there. So that's, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if it's apocryphal, if it's just a legend, but that's the story for how it's got its name. And it's a good story.
Yeah, most etymologies are actually multiple choice anyway. So yeah. we'll go with one of those versions. But it's definitely got some kind of Scottish origin, and it's quite interesting because we're going to talk about the examples of tweed in James Bond in a bit more detail in a bit. But it's got those associations because James Bond is, of course, half Scottish.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there are scenes, particularly in the more recent films, where we've gone to Scotland, particularly Skyfall, and you kind of see that sort of setting in which you can imagine tweed being worn.
Yeah.
And Daniel Craig arguably wears some tweed, but there's so many more examples earlier in the Bond series. Apparently tweed then became associated with wealthy people, because you mentioned about estate tweeds, and I didn't quite understand this bit. So can you sort of unpick that for me?
When I was doing the research, I was wondering whether Bond's family would have been wealthy enough to have an estate tweed and what it would have looked like. So Prince Albert had a tweed designed for Balmoral. So if you think of clan tartans, where like the tartan is like for your family, estate tweeds weren't for a family, they were for the whole estate. And they were sort of unique designs, unique colours, unique patterns, because tweed isn't one, like, pattern. It's a way of weaving as opposed to a particular design. So the Balmoral tweed is still used at Balmoral to this day, and, you know, belongs to the estate. And that happened as the British, you know, English aristocracy bought estates in Scotland. That, like, became more and more of a thing. So tweeds have specific names depending on, like, a number of factors. They all have sort of different names, and there are estate tweeds. So the Balmoral tweed is a particular design that actually has just, like, continued to exist from Prince Albert's design. So yeah, I don't know how wealthy Bond's family history would be, but maybe he has an estate tweed.
Yeah, I mean, if we take the house in Skyfall as a kind of guide, we imagine relatively wealthy. So I think there's a decent chance of there being a Bond tweed, estate tweed out there somewhere. I'm just not sure if we've actually
seen it.
The interesting thing is, though, that something I found particularly interesting anyway, as someone who wears a lot of tweed themselves, without realising that they're wearing a lot of tweed, and it must be said, because I've sent you several WhatsApp messages saying, is this tweed? Is this tweed? You know, different suits I've been wearing over the last few weeks. He said, yes, it's this kind of tweed. What's this kind of tweed called? For the podcast listeners, you won't be able to see it, but What's that one called again?
I mean, it's got an overcheck. I can't quite tell from here whether it's houndstooth or whether it's...
Yeah, I think it's houndstooth.
Yeah, I think it's houndstooth with an overcheck. So we're now going, like, we're now using words people are like that don't know what we're talking about. I'm like, what? So you very likely have tweed somewhere in your wardrobe without realizing it. I think probably the most famous example of tweed in history is Sherlock Holmes' deerstalker hat.
Yes.
You know, and his great coat. Whatever version, like, you can almost guarantee that Benedict Cumberbatch's beautiful long woolen coat is tweed. You know, but the deerstalker hat certainly is. So tweed is named for a number of things. So it can be named for the sheep that it... like the name of the sheep that the wool originally comes from. So you have like Shetland tweed for the sheep that, you know, Shetland sheep wool, which is particularly lovely and soft and fine and gorgeous. It can be named for where it comes from. So like Donegal in Ireland is one of the places that tweed originated. There's Yorkshire tweed, which is where my granddaddy George is from. So the first thing I make out of tweed, I'm going to make out of Yorkshire tweed so that it's for him, in honour of Sir Hilary Brainerd. Then there can be ones where they're named for like the use. So there was a New York gun club, that, in the like late 1800s that like really wanted to sort of be having that, like the association with the British aristocracy and with leisure pursuits and with hunting and fishing and, you know, stalking. And, so they designed a tweed, and it's gun club tweed to this day. Like that's its name. And there's gamekeeper tweed. And then in a very sort of like the woolen version of being bulletproof, there's thornproof tweed, where the weave is such that if you get like, you know, if you're wading through bracken and stuff and you get thorns in your wool, you can kind of like smooth it back over and it won't have holes in it afterwards. Like really utilitarian fabric. And then there's Harris tweed, which is easily globally the most famous, and I'll come back to it because Harris tweed has a really interesting story that I think is like fascinating in how you could like align it with the Bond franchise. But from all of that, all of those tweeds come in different patterns and all of those patterns have different names. So you start kind of like, and that's where something may or may not be tweed, even if it's got a pattern that tweed is famous for. So like tweed can come in plain twill, which as I said is like a diagonal weave, it can, and then the twill can be overchecked, which is the big squares that are on your waistcoat. It can come in plain herringbone, which are those really pretty sort of diagonal lines that meet each other, that look a bit like a fishbone, and that can be overchecked. It can come in like barleycorn and houndstooth, which look a little bit like tiny sort of back teeth of dogs. It can be checked, it can be striped. You know, there were, I think at one point, like over 8,000 designs of Harris tweed alone. So none of those patterns specifically mean that you're wearing tweed. So when I was researching for this, I was like, but what does then? Like, what makes a woolen fabric with those patterns tweed specifically, as opposed to like, because I'm sure there are like other wools made of like Shetland sheep wool that aren't. So I was trying to work out what it was that makes something tweed as opposed to a woven wool that happens to have like a herringbone fabric or a houndstooth or similar. What I discovered that is sort of a key to me about like why the sort of thing that I love with fabric, and with any kind of material as an artist, the things that get me like really excited about something. As an artist, I don't work digitally at all. I'm still very hands-on in the materials I choose to work with. So when I said at the start of this that I'm working with natural fibers, like the natural fiber I've started working with is stinging nettles, which you wouldn't think of as a fiber, but it is. And you can like make cord and start weaving with it. Wow. So the thing that makes tweed completely unique, as far as I know, is that what they do is, you know, you get your wool, it's washed, and then they dye it before they spin it. So normally you'd spin your raw wool and then dye it in batches to get the colour for the yarn, and the yarn is then woven or turned into things for knitting. But with tweed, they dye the loose fibres of the sheep's wool, and then those fibres, which are slightly different colours, are spun together, so that no matter what pattern of tweed you've got, it's going to have these like tiny different flecks of colour appearing in it that are really organic. Okay. And not machine designed at all. And that's because the fibres were all dyed loose and then spun together, so that those like different flecks of colour, which are traditionally drawn from the landscape that tweed comes from, so it's sort of lots of very Scottish hillside colours. So those little bright flecks in amongst all the sort of greens and browns, where you might have little flecks of yellow or little flecks of purple, or they come from having like just dyed vats of loose fibre and then spun them together before they were woven. And that's the thing that makes tweed really different, just to be really, really, really
okay,
niche.
So I think that's, no, it is niche, but really important. And to be honest, I hadn't, in with all this research, I hadn't really twigged that difference, because you see a lot of things with like hound's tooth pattern on them, but it's like, just because it's got a hound's tooth pattern doesn't necessarily mean it's tweed. Is that right?
Yeah.
No.
So if you're like really specific for Sir Hilary Brayday and you're after tweed as opposed to just a woolen coat or a woolen jacket or a woolen waistcoat, or like you want to be like actually looking for the labels of tweed, like look for something that calls itself Yorkshire tweed or Welsh tweed or Donegal tweed or Harris tweed, or because they're like those companies are still making tweed like the traditional way, which is the only way that makes it tweed, as opposed to just a bolt of wool.
You've started making me think whether actually half of what I think is tweed in my wardrobe is actually tweed or not. But to be perfectly honest, look, with Sir Hilary Brayday, I think we're just going to allow it, anything goes on Sir Hilary Brayday. It's like Jim Fanning Friday.
Wear a good piece of wool in a traditional tweed pattern.
that'll do. And it's quite useful that it's because tweed is often quite a warm thing to wear, isn't it? That we're going for April time as well. So I think it's probably the perfect time of year to show off some tweed before we start kind of slipping more into summer type clothing.
Yeah, let's not celebrate Sir Hilary Brayday and wear tweed in August. That would be really silly.
It's funny you say that, though, because the very first mention of tweed in a James Bond novel, and I'm not going to go through them all because there are a lot of them. If you go through Fleming looking for tweed, and I'm aware, because we've said the word tweed about 75 times already today, whenever you say a word and you focus on it, it starts sounding really, really strange. So apologies to listeners like going, I'm sick of hearing the word tweed already, because you're about to hear several more. But the first mention of tweed in Casino Royale is in Casino Royale in Fleming. And it's where Bond notices some people at an outdoor cafe drinking champagne and martinis in unseasonable tweeds. And that novel is set in June. So it's a slightly snobby remark, I think, from Bond to say, why are they still wearing tweed in June?
Yeah. Or it's just really like, you know, I think it's a twofold, isn't it? It's potential snobbery on his part, but it's also like the practicality of like Bond coming out, like he's not going to be sitting in something that makes him hot. Like, how stupid would he have to be? Unless there was like a really important undercover reason. He's like, it's June, you don't wear wool. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't think James Bond has a particularly positive view of tweed in the books. So a lot of time it's worn by people who are the villains. There is a notable exception. So in the Fewer Eyes Only short story, Bond wears a black and white houndstooth tweed suit. But then he's told by the kind of local operative helping him that he's going to have to change into something less fancy, less conspicuous. And he's going to have to, because he's supposed to be kind of stalking someone through some woods. So he's going to have to kind of blend in. Whereas I think a black and white houndstooth jacket, which I think I've actually got one somewhere, so maybe we'll see that on Sir Hilary Brayday, would probably kind of be more like urban tweed, whereas it's usually got a rural associate.
I was gonna say that's interesting, because if you're stalking someone through the woods or through the countryside, then actually like tweed as one of the early forms of like camouflage clothing would have been the thing you'd think Bond should be wearing, because that's like the like one of the reasons for its like strong association with the aristocracy in this country was that it became the sort of unofficial uniform of like, you know, like deer stalking and hunting and fishing and all yeah, grand leisure pursuits. Yeah, because it was camouflage, and because it was like muted colours and it was warm, and I think like, you know, it was used like specifically because you could hide out in the Scottish hills in it. So he was just wearing the wrong tweed.
Yeah, exactly. Wrong tweed, Bond, not disguised tweed, not camouflage tweed.
He had London tweed on. That was his problem.
That's it. And yeah. It's interesting what you just said. It sparked off a memory because about hunting and those associations. Ian Fleming's family loved hunting, but Bond himself, I'm mixing them up myself, Ian himself hated hunting and he hated that side of his family. So I'm kind of wondering what if tweed gets a sort of bad reputation in the books. Maybe it's kind of playing on those associations that he had with tweed as he was growing up.
Yeah, I mean, he would have come from a time like before tweed was reclaimed for like different, you know, different pieces of different walks in society, different pieces of culture, where those really strong associations with sort of, you know, it kind of, you know, trickled down from the aristocracy into the Victorian middle classes because of the association with the aristocracy and leisure activities. The middle classes wanted to be able to wear it to go golfing and to play tennis, and can't imagine playing tennis in wool, but anyway, they did full suits. And I wonder if, you know, as you say, Fleming's, you know, potential distaste for it was that kind of fussy association with things that he didn't like, pieces of his family that he didn't like, and probably people he'd met in the service that were, you know, wearing it for their particular, you know, class of people that he also didn't like very much. Whether or not, you know, so were he writing today, it would have very different associations as a fabric.
Yeah.
It's been used
I think you can kind of see that. You can see that in the film. So Fleming died in 1964. It's interesting that Bond wears his first tweed suit in Goldfinger, which was released in 1964. And it's a very much loved suit by a lot of Bond fans. It's the one he wears when he's driving the Aston Martin through Switzerland, chasing Goldfinger. And it's quite a subtle... not even sure it would count as Czech, but it's a really nice brown tweed suit. Not all of the tweed suits in Bond are lauded as much of that one. There's a really interesting article that I read by Matt Spazer, who runs the Bond Suits website, which is kind of my go-to for Bond fashion, really. and he says that a lot of the time tweed is used to kind of... There's kind of young looking tweeds and old looking tweeds.
Yeah.
And I'd agree sometimes with that. Bond looks really young in them, and sometimes he looks old in them. And I think sometimes he wears the old looking tweeds, like when he plays Hilary Bray and like when he plays St. John Smythe in View to a Kill, to kind of age up the character.
Mm-hmm.
So it does still have this. But then again, other times he can kind of wear them to age down.
Yeah. That's really interesting. That's. Costume designers really understanding the sort of associations of the fabric they're making the suits from, and the associations with the different cuts of, you know, the different tailoring that you'd use those fabrics for. And I think that switch in the 60s, like Coco Chanel was a big fan of tweed. Like, it's not just men's fashion that tweed shows up in, you know, Coco Chanel was a big fan of tweed. As was Vivienne Westwood, who used Harris tweed in a lot of her clothing. You know, anywhere that there's sort of obvious wool, you know, fabric and tartans and things going on in Westwood, they're very likely to be tweed. As have, you know, the top men's fashion designers throughout history, right up to today. You know, I'm sure you can find a really good Tom Ford tweed suit with ease. And we all know how good Daniel Craig looks in a Tom Ford suit. So, you know, I think that, like, if you're a costume designer, you could go with the sort of old-fashioned patterns, colours, but also cut, you know, how, you know, what you do with the jacket and, you know, double-breasted, single-breasted, how many buttons, whatever. Tweed has particular things that it's good for in your suit. And how sort of interesting you make the pattern. Because as we said, there's a lot of choices with tweed. Some of them easily could be made kind of old and stuffy and, you know, age a character up because audiences would immediately see it and think of, you know, even if you're not a fashion historian, even if you don't realize you're thinking of it, if you've watched enough other dramas and enough other movies, you might see it and immediately start thinking of particular sort of, you know, Downton Abbey type things or costume dramas or like any costume drama about the royal family where like it's got that association with it. But equally, you know, choose the right piece of tweed and your association are the Peaky Blinders, who have spawned an incredibly fashionable period, you know, period now of clothing that's harking back to something where the designers of Peaky Blinders use tweed a lot. Tommy Shelby looks great in tweed. and it's, you know, they kill people with it. It's literally a weapon. Like, all their flat caps are tweed and they're murdering people with it. So, you know, I think it got this breadth that you can use it for to communicate with people.
For those not well versed in Peaky Blinders, what you've been missing out for a start. I feel a connection with it's Peaky Blinders is set around where I live, obviously in the 100 plus years ago, but they wear these. It's based sort of on some factual detail that gangsters used to wear these flat caps and they put razor blades in the peak of the cap. So I've never thought about that. Tweed can be deadly.
And I think if you're thinking about that sort of dual understanding of the fabric, it's really interesting to think that Downton Abbey and Peaky Blinders start at roughly the same time period. And tweed is being used in both of those incredibly successful British dramas in the two ways that we're talking about them using it in the Bond franchise. It's being used in that sort of speaking to sort of British tradition, and it's being used in that speaking to sort of something a bit more contemporary and a bit more cutting edge and a bit younger. And it's from like two sort of period pieces being made in literally the same period using the same fabric in completely different ways. That are both then, you know, from what you're saying, evident in the way the costume designers have used it in Bond. So
I'm really intrigued about your theory about Harris Tweed and James Bond.
Yeah. So I, when I started researching, if you just put the very sort of general term history of tweed into Google, the first thing that comes up is actually the history of Harris Tweed specifically, for good reason. It's very, very famous and has a really interesting history. And the more I was researching, not just like what tweed is, but the specifically the history of Harris tweed, the more parallels I found myself drawing to the James Bond franchise specifically, that I just think are really, really interesting and incredibly British. In the Gentleman Gazette article, they said that tweed is as close to national dress as we get, which I think is true. And I know that, like, globally, British wool and British tweed specifically are like a really big thing for designers and you know, throughout history. And I think it would be fair to say that if tweeds are national dress, then Harris tweed is the actual symbol of that. So to explain what Harris tweed is, as opposed to the others, it's tweed that has to be woven on the islands of the Hebrides. So, you know, it's Scottish Bond. And it has to be finished in one of the sort of very few, very specific factories and mills on certain islands in the Hebrides. It's actually like protected legally. Like Harris Tweed is protected under the law. It's the oldest certification mark that we have in Britain is the like orb with the crown that comes with Harris Tweed that people might be familiar with. So it's like, I guess it's a trademark, and it was brought in to protect like the importance of the crafting of Harris tweed specifically from knockoffs, which reminds me, not just of like any kind of trademark protecting things from knockoffs, but of sort of any traditional craft or art that comes from like people indigenous to any specific country, whether that's sort of you know, First Nation Canadians or Aboriginal Australians or the Sami people in Northern Europe or Native Americans or sort of traditional craft throughout India or like silk making and, you know, in Asia. Like, it's that like really specific craft to a specific place where you don't want the knockoff of it, you want the real thing. So there's something called the Harris Tweed Authority that like will give people the certification mark as to whether or not their tweed like meets the rules and the Hebrides for like being specifically Harris Tweed, which is just like, it's so brilliant to think that there is this like place where the craft of making tweed, the history of making tweed, is so sort of intrinsically woven into British history. And it was the Harris Tweed Weavers that Lady Dunmore went to when she wanted her tartan in the 1800s. So like the beginning of the popularization of tweed also came from the Harris Tweed Weavers. Like, they made her tartan so well that that's how it began to spread out. But then in 2006, a guy named Brian Haggis, who was a textile merchant, bought Kenneth Mackenzie Mill, which would produce something like 95% of Harris tweed. And he almost immediately reduced the number of unique patterns of Harris tweed from about 8,000 to 4, which is just the most insane business decision. And then outsourced the production of like Harris tweed, essentially, and the clothing that was made from it. So it was like being woven in the Hebrides still, sort of, and then being sent to China to be made into like fast fashion, ready to wear coats. And he had like 75,000 of them or something ready to go. He like wanted to just corner the market on tweed. And he had all these suits ready so that you could like order your jacket and have it within 24 hours, all very like Amazon Prime of him. And completely unsurprisingly, no one bought it. So he like basically overnight almost killed the tweed industry, which is just mental. And it was saved by two people. It was saved by a guy from New York named Alan Bain and a former British trade minister named Brian Wilson, who bought two of the remaining mills on the Hebrides. And then it was saved by just a complete fluke, where there was found in a like warehouse somewhere on the Hebrides something like 8,000 of the designs, the traditional Harris tweed designs, just like left mouldering in a warehouse, so they could like rejuvenate all the things that he'd destroyed. So it still like massively shrunk the industry, and it went from sort of being this like huge producer to being this like small craft producer. But then the Harris Tweed Authority, like being very like savvy, I guess, started then like using their trademark to work with other designers. So I think there might even be a pair of Harris Tweed Nike Jordan Airs in like the world's weirdest mashup. Just to like really like, they would like, you know, using the brand name to make it really popular. When I was reading it, the thing that made me think of the Bond franchise was that the brilliance, the absolute genius and brilliance of the way that the books and the movies set themselves up at the very, very beginning, and keeping the books in the hands of his family, essentially, and the estate, and keeping the movies in the hands of the same family and keeping it with the Broccolis. Because it would have been so easy, as you said earlier when we were talking about Joanna Harwood, it would have been so easy at any point in the long and storied history of the two sort of versions of this franchise, whether it's in the book or in the movies, for Bond to have been bought out by someone like Brian Haggis, who thought they could corner the market on it and turn it into something that it isn't, and not understand what people love about it, or the essential Britishness of it, or the sort of quintessential part of our collective heritage, or the craft of it, and the importance of the specific things that make it Bond, as opposed to like making it any old spy movie. And instead, like, it was always with people like the people that came in and rescued it, or with people like the Harris Tweed Authority. Like, if you you could easily compare the Fleming Estate and the Broccolis to the Harris Tweed Authority and trademarking it in the way that they have so staunchly protected, like, so that there are knockoff versions of James Bond floating around left, right, and centre. Like, you couldn't get away with it in the same way that, you know, they made that certification mark for Harris Tweed so that they couldn't be knockoff versions of Harris Tweed. And Harris Tweed has helped, like, continue driving an industry where Tweed is being made all over the world and it's really popular and, you know, it's being made all over Britain. And in the same way that Bond's helped spawn multiple other franchises that have nothing to do with him, except that they do because their DNA is, like, sitting in the James Bond franchise. But like, the specificity of Bond himself hasn't been allowed to be kind of outsourced to China and turned into some sort of horrible fast fashion thing that people wouldn't actually want and therefore killed.
It's not being diluted, has it? So yeah, it's exactly. If that's the right word. But that's a really brilliant kind of conceit that the way that Tweed has been, you know, he's that quintessential British thing and essentially and emblematic of Britain in a sense. Bond is along those lines as well. That quote has jumped from that article you sent me. That quote jumped out to me as well. So again, Tweed is as close to British national dress as you might get. Mm. So for it's interesting then that Bond hasn't worn even more Tweed than he already has, because it has appeared in several of the films. So maybe whatever happens with the next Bond film, maybe we should put on our absolute non-negotiables list. Bond must wear Tweed.
On Harris Tweed specifically. Like, I want him in Harris Tweed.
I think I've only got a Harris Tweed bag. I don't think in fact, I actually bought it when I was in Edinburgh this time last year, meeting your when I met up with your sister, actually, and I realised I didn't have something to carry books and stuff in. So I went and bought a Harris Tweed bag, and I went into the shop and you could literally get Harris Tweed everything. It's funny you said about Nike Air Max or whatever. But if you do visit a city centre in Scotland, you will find a Harris Tweed shop at somewhere. So if you don't have any, head to one of those stores and you'll find more Tweed than you can ever imagine.
Yeah, what to do with, yeah, for sure. That was my parallel to the James Bond franchise.
Yeah, and I love that theory. What the
franchise has avoided by being guarded by people that care about it so much.
Yeah. No, I think that's a brilliant theory. Have you decided yourself what you're going to wear for Sir Hilary Bray Day on the 1st of April?
I don't actually have any Tweed, which I now need to go and correct. Other than these little samples. I've got a little stack of samples of Tweed, which are beautiful. all the Yorkshire Tweed. I really want to be able to spend Sir Hilary Bray Day sewing the very beautiful vintage Vogue 1950s cape pattern that I'm going to make out of Tweed, but I don't know if I will have been able to afford to buy any yet. So in the meantime, I'm going to go hunting in some vintage shops and find myself a Tweed something.
Did I see in that sample there's a purple one? It's
mostly purple. It's a pile of mostly purple Tweed.
Purple is my favourite colour, so I think I need to go and find some purple.
I've got some nice green ones in here as well, but
okay.
Yeah.
So if you've not put the date in your diary yet, 1st of April 2024, and it'll be the 1st of April forevermore. We're not gonna move this one around because obviously in celebration of George Baker's birthday. Oh, actually, I forgot to mention earlier. I forgot it's actually George Baker MBE as well, isn't it? Because he got an MBE for his charity work.
He did indeed.
So he had, one of those. He had one of the So yeah, one of those bad boys. So no, like, I might wear that as well, just to kind honor. Of finish off the look, finish off the Tweedy look.
Yeah. So everybody's got time now to go.
Yeah.
To their local charity shops and vintage shops and go and find themselves an excellent piece of tweed to wear in honor of Sir Hilary Bray.
I was going to say, because tweed is not the cheapest necessarily, is it? Because if it is traditional tweed, which is why I think you've got me thinking now about this kind
tweed.
Of whether it's actually proper tweed or not. You've got me doubting everything in my wardrobe now. But we're not going to be picky. We're not going to draw that distinction for Sir Hilary Brader.
Proper tweed is also 100% wool, which, as somebody who is against fast fashion and against plastic fibres in my clothing, makes me like it even more.
Hard wearing over time.
No, polyester, thank you. So yeah, if you don't have any
Hillary Bray
or you fancy something new to celebrate Sir Hilary Bray Day, go secondhand. You will find it, plenty of it, in charity shops and vintage shops across the country. Or go to the Harris Tweed Authority and buy yourself something small and luxurious to help keep their weavers
alive.
Yeah,
it could just be a little accessory.
Yeah, little accessory.
You know what I thought? I think if I don't already have one, I think I need a tweed bow tie.
I was about to say that.
I'm going to have a look through the bow tie selection in a minute just to see if I've already got one. And even if I've already got one, I'll just buy another one anyway.
Yeah.
I don't need an excuse to buy bow ties.
No. To quote the doctor, bow ties are cool.
Bow ties are cool, and that'll be a nice link between Jim Fanning Friday and Sir Hilary Bray Day.
Yeah.
Let's, and then maybe we can kind of have one a month might be a bit too much, but maybe we need to look at some other minor characters from James Bond stories and we'd build celebrations around this. I have a feeling this could start a whole movement.
A calendar of Bond celebrations.